For most of his life, he's been one of us, a genuine, hard-at-it media man, dishing out sport and current affairs. And as a producer, he pushed around such luminaries as Ray Charles, Dame Kiri Takanawa, James Galway and his flute, even Spike Milligan. And that may be getting a little closer to the mystery. 8 years ago, someone gave him a saucepan, a knife, and some assorted Western Australian produce and pushed him in front of a camera. The result is that he's become not only a foodie, but one of our greatest, and even one the French say is a télégourmand of them all. With that, he upped and created the World Food Media Awards and the Fabulous Tasting Australia, now about to engulf Adelaide in a lot of eating and drinking. And that, of course, must be bliss. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bliss himself in Palmetto.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President, what an introduction. I don't know really where to go from there, but I shall try to give you all some idea of where I did come from and how all this Tasting Australia happened and where we intend to take Tasting Australia in the future. You'll notice that I'm accompanied by a trusty glass of water. The drink that I have on the show is, of course, coloured water. I never drink wine. And the other thing I don't think I do is to have leering and boggling eyes on camera, which I read in today's Australian, a lovely piece on Tasting Australia that describes me thus, and I thought that was really not what I was about at all. Now, what I'd like to do is just if I can gauge from you all today something about your culinary knowledge, I'll just like to ask you a quick question, and I'll then call for a show of hands to see how much you know. And the question is, which has the most fat in it? Is it olive oil, butter, or margarine? Which has the most fat? Olive oil, butter, or margarine? Now, hands up those people who think olive oil has the most fat. Right. Hands up those who think the butter has the most fat. Oh. And how about margarine? Okay. Now, if I could have a look at the hands that showed me olive oil again, you were absolutely right. So give yourselves pats on the back, because olive oil is 100% fat and the other two are not. They're diluted with other things. I'm surprised that the Women's and Children's Hospital with us today didn't have many takers, but I'm sure I'll have an answer for that later. Now, I understand that the title for my address today was Cooking Up a Storm. And as I was saying to Don a little earlier, it really should have been called Not Exactly a Celebrity. And the reason for that is I was in a Sydney restaurant the other day with my publishers, and as happens very seldom, towards the end of the evening, somebody was emboldened enough to come over to the table and say, "Look, I love your show. I love your show. My wife loves your show. My kids cook from your books. And I hope you don't mind me just saying that, but you're not exactly a celebrity, are you?" So that really, it was a very nice way of putting me in my place, and I guess that's true. Although, last time I was in Adelaide, when we had the launch of Tasting Australia program, I was taken for celebrity. We were just finishing, wrapping up, and the crews had gone home, and there was this observer standing off behind the barricade, and he said, hey mate. So of course, I left the people I was with and wandered over, and he said, "You play footy, don't you?" And I said, "Of course I do." And he said, "How many goals was it again?" And I said, "I think it was 1,300. He said, "Plugger, you little beauty." And then he walked away about 10, 15 metres, and suddenly I saw him go, and he turned around and he said, "You're that bloody cook on TV." Which only goes to show the power of the media. Now, since I've been given very generously a half an hour, and normally I get 5 minutes, half hours are usually only reserved for people like Stephanie Alexander. Sorry, I couldn't resist. I thought I'd divide my half an hour into an entree, a main, and a dessert. And the entree is really, how did it all begin? How did I get into doing Consuming Passions? And the main will really be what has been the effect of Consuming Passions, and the dessert will be Tasting Australia, which is the reason that I'm here now. To give you some idea, as Don mentioned, I did go to the second oldest school in England, which was founded in 604 by Bishop Gundulf, who had nothing to do with The Hobbit, but actually was the real founder of King's School in Rochester, which is the school that also had Charles Dickens. And it was refounded in 1542 by King Henry VIII, but that's another story. And we had all the first cooks who started with the school, we were convinced were still there, still cooking the same things. So we'd have wonderful dishes. The gourmet delight was the Sunday night where we'd have hot tinned pilchards in vinegary tomato sauce on toast, which is fine if you want to do it fresh. But this has been plated up sadistically at 3 p.m. so that we could enjoy it at 5:30. There were other sadistic exercises they carried out. So I grew up as a child in an environment that was, let's just say, difficult culinarily. I used to cook in the fume cupboards of the chemistry laboratory, things like fish fingers. And between making hydrogen cyanide gas, because we boys thought, it would be interesting to see what they'd use in gas chambers. So we just happily bellowed hydrogen cyanide out into the Rochester surrounds. But I emerged from that, and I was doing a few calculations yesterday, and I realized that what you see before you, under the shirt, is 60,000 breakfasts, lunches, and dinners. Which is, and to my great shame, the contents of a reasonable liquor store. Something around 1,000 cases of wine. And I've also realized that I've 50-something years since I was on the breast. So that's a long time. So how did I come to become a food guru, has been mentioned? Well, my background, as I mentioned, was King's School, Rochester. I was born post-war into working-class North London suburb of Tottenham. And my father worked for Whitbread's, the brewery that many of you may know, which he worked for 50 years, and is still going strong, I'm pleased to report. My mother is a duck. At least her mother was a duck. That was her. So my mother's maiden name was Duck. And her mother worked below stairs in a London house for a rich family of furriers. So there is a sort of loose tie with the culinary arts there. Fortunately, at the age of nine, I was whisked away from this penitentiary, as I thought it was, and taken to live in Belgium, where I didn't know anything about Belgian food. In fact, nor did my parents. But, of course, Belgian food, and especially in the late 50s and early 60s, was as good as it gets. Although the French author Baudelaire said, thank God for French cookbooks, because at least in Belgium you can read about good food. But then that's just, you know, just the French being a bit picky. So I grew up on pâté de foie. I used to take pâté de foie, in real pâté de foie, in freshly baked French breads off to school, and I really grew to love eating and cooking, and had a Belgian housekeeper who taught me how to make mayonnaise at the age of nine. And I don't know, those of you who have been to Belgium, you will have had chips with mayonnaise, which I still think, I mean, I'm getting horrific looks from the Women's and Children's Hospital down here. But we grew up on chips and mayonnaise and as much fat as you can get, and we seemed to thrive on it. I went back to England to go to this boarding school of which you've heard a little, and then really at the end of my school time, I was thrown out of school, and my father said, it's because you wear jeans. You'll never get anywhere in life wearing jeans. Actually, I've never told him why I was thrown out of school, and I don't intend telling you now. But it may come up in an autobiography at some stage. But this was the time in the 60s when England swung as a pendulum do or did. And, you know, it was the time of, you know, high-heel white boots, thigh-length white boots and mini skirts and beehive hairdos. And the women weren't dressed much better, I have to say. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but my father has said, you should, if you're not going into the brewery business, you should be in plastics. So he said, next door is the director of the company that makes plastics. So I went off to work in this company, and another thing I never told my parents is the plastics they produced were false teeth. And all of you are much too young to know what false teeth are, but they come in all shades and sizes. So I was working in this factory that made false teeth. It's a bit like a shoe shop, you know, different sizes, different colours. And this particular factory would make false teeth in little size. I think they called them size. It's a bit like type sizes in print. It sort of starts off at sort of an 8-point and goes up to a 72-point. And it goes from, you know, the little weeny pearly ones to the great big yellow fangs. And I, just for fun, as a boy, as one did, I used to juggle them up. You know, I'd send out a set of neat little 12-point whites with one fang from the shade 7, which was extremely naughty. And I realized that I wasn't actually that suited to industry. Or much else, really, which is how I got into journalism. And my first paper, actually, was Psychic News. And if I'd been any good at the business, I would have known that that was not a career that was destined to go very far. But eventually I did get into serious publishing and worked in newspapers and magazines in London for some 6 years or so, 7 years, I think, just long enough to get the itch. And in that time, I had got to know the better watering holes of Fleet Street rather well. And actually, it is amazing when I think back that in those days, even in London, there were bars that women couldn't drink in. El Vino's was one. I don't know if any of you remember London and El Vino's, but I think it took a brigade from the Observer newspaper of women going in there, led by Catherine Whitehorn from Emory, to actually turn that around. And this is London we're talking about at the end of the 60s, so it's quite an extraordinary state of affairs in London. Now, the reason that I left London to come to Australia was nothing to do with the journalism, which I actually loved, but it was more to do with the fact that that I spent too many nights sitting in the bath with a bowl of spaghetti and a gut-scouring Spanish red and my wife. Because that's the only way we could keep warm. And we just top up the bath every few minutes and we seem to be happy, and then eventually we go to bed. And I kid you not, it was so cold, we put our clothes in the oven in the mornings to warm up, and in the summer it really wasn't much better. And the other big problem was Janet's chest, because she had very bad bronchitis, and her doctor said, look, if you don't go somewhere warm and dry to live, like, you know, this is going to be the end of you, which is a nice sort of bedside manner that some London GPs had. So we didn't really know where to go. So we looked at the atlas and spun it round and the globe and said, well, you know, it has to be somewhere like South Africa or Australia. And well, we thought, well, we really don't want to go from London to Melbourne or Sydney. We'd rather go to somewhere pleasant and not too busy. I thought you'd like that. I wouldn't dare do that in Melbourne. So Perth seemed nice, so I trotted along to WA House in the Strand and saw their PR, the WA PR rep, a former journalist from the Daily News in Perth, and I went along to see him and I said, look, I'm a journalist, I'm thinking of going to Perth to live. And he said, you're joking, you're out of your mind. I said, why? He said, there's no journalism in WA. He said, we've got the West, we've got the Daily News and the Sunday Times. No one's writing anything. So I hope we don't have any sort of ex. So I said, well, it sounds fine anyway. Look, I'll get a job. So I moved over there and got a job in PR, which is fascinating because I had clients like Bunnings and the Liberal Party and Steel Supplies, and lots of good, honest, resource-led private companies, including the Liberal Party, I suspect, at the time over there. And so I'd get flown around the countryside in WA, and it was a great introduction. I mean, there were occasions where I'd get lost in fact, I was lost flying down to the southwest to look at the Bunnings Mills, and they had some in those days. And we actually landed in a paddock, and I had to ask cockies for, you know, directions to local mills. It was it was a fantastic time. And it wasn't long before I moved into television in the form of an appointment as publicity officer for the ABC. In Perth, and at that time, it was before they had commercials. They had promos, which meant a slide would come up. In fact, they weren't even slides, there were cards on a rostrum, and a camera was pointing at it so long ago. And the camera would point at these things, and I would get an announcer to say, tomorrow night in Melbourne, another exciting episode, as... And that was how the commercials were all run. I mean, it was amazing. So I was writing stuff for radio promos, television promos, and doing media batches. We had a wonderful Yorkshireman who was the head of that department, who was so he's head of PR, and he hated people. And he never had a preview of any program the ABC produced. So he would, he would just send out media releases. And one day I said, why don't we invite some media people into the ABC, show them this, and give them a drink? He said, oh, we're not wasting bloody beer on bloody press. He was one of those, former subs that we're all afraid of, sub-editors who, was a sort of an iron fist in a titanium glove. And, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of you have worked with those sort of subs in the past. They're sort of from the Pol Pot School of Management. And this one had found his way into Australia and into the ABC, and that's why I soon moved away from PR and into production. And that probably gets me close to the start of the main course. Just one moment while I turn this huge page. Oh, by the way, you should never, I don't know if you know this, but you should never eat in a restaurant where the menu is bigger than the table. It's, one of the tips, actually, coming out in my latest Consuming Passions book here, Cooking with Passion. So I moved into television production, and on the news CAF side, News and Current Affairs, working on things like TDT Nationwide, and I think I even started on a bit of 7:30 Report. I was the first director of Geraldine Doogue, that wonderful former journalist, now, well, I suppose once a journalist, always a journalist, who actually pushed me in the direction of starting to write recipe books, and it was a total accident, but she said to me, because she was working the shift that finished at 8 and I was working on the studio floor with her, and she said, look, I've got a problem that I need a recipe that I can cook when I get home from my husband, who some of you may know of, Tim Blue, who writes finance for the Australian. And I said, but he's at home, and you get there at 8:30. Why doesn't he cook? Oh, you're kidding. So I said, I have the perfect recipe for you. It's fettuccine Alfredo. It's very simple. I said, I will write down the instructions exactly, and if you follow these, you'll get a perfect dish every time. So most of you are probably aware of fettuccine Alfredo, which is basically egg noodles, cream, butter, Parmesan cheese, a little nutmeg, and black pepper. So I said, this is what you do. You cook the noodles, and then all you have to do is melt the butter. I mean, this is, again, one of those ones where nutritionists will go, oh, no. You melt the butter, pour in the cream, add the nutmeg and the black pepper, add some Parmesan cheese, and then toss the cooked noodles, through this mixture. So I thought that was simple enough. Anyway, the day after she prepared this dish, she said, oh, Tim is going to kill you when he sees you. That dish, that noodles Alfredo, it was awful. And I said, it couldn't be awful. That is the foolproof recipe. She said, I followed everything exactly. And I said, tell me what you did. And she said, well, I cooked the macaroni. And I said, hey, hold it. You cooked what? Oh, we didn't have noodles. We had macaroni. So I cooked the macaroni. Okay. And then I made this mixture that you said. I said, yes, how did you make it? She said, well, I put this. Oh, we didn't use butter. So I put this margarine in a pot. And Tim doesn't like things like cream, so I used some Hilo milk, and we didn't have any Parmesan, so I used cheddar. And I said, so you made a sort of a very poor macaroni cheese. She said, no, fettuccine Alfredo, you wrote it down, that's the dish. And I thought, there's a book here somewhere. And it was a book that I went off to France, because I thought, book writing would be nice. I got the trusty long service leave. Off I went to France and spent 6 months there, I thought, writing the Neurotics food book for people just like Geraldine, but using as a base French food. And then I discovered that after spending several months living in mostly French hotels and restaurants, that the food here is actually much better. And I thought, why am I writing a book on basically French food, Provençal cuisine, and a bit of Italian and Spanish thrown in, when I could be writing something that is about the food we do so well? So I came back and didn't write the book. I carried on doing programs, as Don mentioned, with like Luna State Concerts with some great performers, and worked with Spike Milligan, who, incidentally, I don't know if any of you are fans of Spike Milligan, but I went to see his show, and I went to see the same one-man show every night that he performed it. The first night I thought, this man is extraordinary. His power to ad-lib the way he does is just sensational. How does he do it? I'm going to have trouble covering this for television. So I went the next night, and all his ad-libbing was exactly the same. Exactly, word for word. And he, in fact, turned out to be the most disciplined comedian I've ever come across. Tim Gregg, welcome. Just so there. So I'm working with these people, and suddenly in 1990, the sadistic head of ABC television, Paddy Conroy, who's also a bit of a miser, came over to Perth. I was working on the Australian Film Awards in Melbourne at the time, and he came over and had dinner with me, and he said, "You know that Peter Russell Clark? Come and get it." He said, "I've got to get him off." He said, "I've had so many complaints. 2 weeks ago, he walked around his farm and then cooked one of his peacocks." And he said, "The peacock happens to be like a great religious symbol for some religion, and he's just cooked one of their priests." He said, "I've got to get." Last week he talked about stabbing explorer stabbing their horses and drinking the blood when they He said, "I've got to get him off." He said, "I want to do a new food show, and I want you to do it." And I said, "That's terrific, because I've never thought of doing a food show, because I've never had anything to do with food professionally." And he said, just like Peter Russell Clark, but much better, much more fun, more accessible, not so boring. And I said, "Well, that's terrific. But who are you going to get to host it? Because, good TV presenters are thin on the ground, and they certainly were over in WA. And he said, "Oh, you present it? Oh, yeah, you present it." And I said, "Me? You're kidding, why?" And he said, "Because you're cheap." He said, "We don't have to pay you any extra. We already employ you as a producer-director, so, you can write the scripts, you can produce, direct, and then you can stand in the front of the camera and do it. Easy." And I said, "Hello." And he said, "Well, it's that or you go back to doing news for the rest of your career." Okay? So faced with that prospect, I thought, well, I might just try this. And I thought, well, what am I going to do to make a cooking segment that is not just a recipe show for people who are interested in food? So I thought, what I have to come up with is something that is like a play school for grown-ups. And that, I think, is what it's become. And that's why it's popular with, Marilyn Manson fans, for one thing. I was at the Hilton Adelaide on a previous visit. I'd just got out of a taxi from a very good meal somewhere, and it was when A Big Day Out was on, and the hotel was chocker with Julian Lennons and Marilyn Mansons, and all their supporters were sitting grungily on the steps. And I thought, my God, I've got to get through this lot, and there's no porter on the steps. And suddenly a bunch of these black, bedraggled creatures in their late teens got up and approached, and I went, "Ah!" And they said, "Hey, man, high fives, whoa, love your show, yeah, you saved our lives, man, whoa, yeah." And I walked in there, and I found that people in the hotel at that vintage knew who I was, and not only that, didn't think I was necessarily an old fart, but was actually somebody that could relate to them, which I thought was terrific. So, having started in 1990, I'd done something like, I think it was 7 years, 6 years in production, when I was invited to go to France for the major awards, the Festival International Télé Gourmande in Deauville, France, where 50-odd networks from 50-odd countries were putting their shows up. And in the first year, I won Best Presenter Award. And I was sort of pretty amazed at that. In fact, there were three of us who thought we wouldn't win anything. One Canadian, one English presenter, and I thought, "We're not going to win anything. I know what we'll do. So that we can go home without losing face, we'll go down to the local trophy shop and we'll buy our trophies, and we'll present them to each other on the night." And of course we engraved, mine was L'Andouille d'Or. Now, I don't know if you know L'Andouille, but it's basically a tripe sausage. So I won the golden tripe sausage, and my other friends similarly. So we won this prize. And then, of course, we said, "Oh, looking forward to seeing you next year at the next festival." And I thought, well, next year certainly won't win anything, but it's good networking. So I went back there the next time. And all the awards were handed out, and it got to the last two or three. And I thought, well, that's it. I'm certain I haven't won anything. And eventually there's only one left, and it's the big award, the Grand Prix. And suddenly it's, "Mesdames et Messieurs, et le grand de la Coupe d'Or, Australie, Yann Parmenter." Because I went, "Oh, shit." I don't believe it. So I got up on the stage and I ad-libbed some French speech, which unfortunately I don't remember afterwards because I have no idea what I said. It was a lot of, qu'est-ce que c'est, le grand chose, magnifique. So, interestingly, of course, we communicated with dear old auntie. Now, I know that because this is a press club lunch, none of this is on the record. I communicated with auntie, you know, to their PR department and said, look, we've just won this award. And they said, we probably won't do anything on it. It's a bit incestuous. I kid you not. It's a bit incestuous to promote the fact an ABC show has won a major international award. But the Today Show had a different view, and they decided that they would have me in the studio in London, and I would do a live cross to Steve Liebman in Sydney, and got back, and there's still no interest from the ABC, which I thought was fantastic. At that time, I'd put a proposal up to the ABC to do a series called Tasting Australia. And I think we're heading into the dessert now. Tasting Australia. And it was a series of... Now, stop me if this sounds familiar... 7 programmes looking at the regional cuisines of Australia, starting with Western Australia, and looking at such things as goat cheese from Gabriel Cavella, Jim Mendolia's sardines. Now, I can probably tell from the sniggering that some of you saw the first episode of A Shared Table and know that that's exactly what was covered in that first episode. So, I'm going back 2 or 3 years, said, OK, look, the ABC don't want half hours from us. This is to my business partner, David Evans. So let's do something else. I mean, we've got the concept of Tasting Australia as a look at Australian food, and we are really underselling ourselves in Australia to overseas markets in food and wine tourism. Let's do something about it. Now, one of the other things that had occurred was at the end of the second year in France, a lot of the network people were saying, I'm not coming back here again. I mean, it's just every meal we get in the Deauville restaurant is identical, absolutely identical. Scotch beef, because they were the major sponsor, little string beans wrapped in bacon, camembert or port salut, because they were the only 2 cheeses made there, and an apple tart. Now, if you're there for 10 days, and you eat that twice a day, you know... And the other problem was a lot of the people were coming from countries where meat wasn't eaten at all, and there was no vegetarian option. They couldn't even eat the beans because they're wrapped in bacon. So a lot of these countries are saying, look, let's not do it again. And I said, look, why don't you come to Australia? Now, that's where you really get to eat. And they said, well, we've seen your show, and you've won these 2 things, so let's talk about it. So that's when I came back here, and I approached initially Australian Major Events. And we talked to Bill Spurr, who's happily here today. And we talked to Graham Ingerson, who at that time was Tourism Minister. And we talked to Dean Brown, at that time Premier. And said, look, have we got an offer for you? You know, you've got buckets of money left over from all the profits you've made from the Grand Prix. And why don't we do something that is much more enduring than rubber on roads? Let's do a festival and let's make it a biennial and let's incorporate a World Food Media Awards and get the world to come down here and just see how smart we are. So in what we expected would be a sort of the typical governmental, and I have to say that I imagine it would be a fairly slow process in most states, in what seemed like no time, we had approval to run Tasting Australia number 1 in 1997, the core of which would be the World Food Media Awards. And it was intended largely to be a media event where we would host 150 media in Adelaide and South Australia, and they would go home and tell the rest of the world what fabulous things we were doing here, which they did. And I have mountains of press cuttings, and funnily enough, they're still coming in. I think I saw a Wine and Dine from Asia came in a couple of weeks ago with a 12-page supplement that was done while the writers were here for Tasting Australia 2 years ago. And this is why the Tasting Australia concept is an enduring one, because we're not just working for a one-week event. We're working for year-round promotion of what's happening in Adelaide and South Australia. Why choose South Australia, I hear you ask, or hear some of you ask, because it was the obvious place to do it. We had an infrastructure here which could cope with large groups of international visitors. We had excellent wineries, some of the best restaurants in the country. We had Chong Liu, who I regard as one of the 2 best chefs in the world, the other one being Tetsuya Wakuda in Sydney. We had them at our disposal. So this would be the logical place. It's also a central place. You can come in from Europe via Perth. You can come in via Darwin. You can come in via the eastern, we still call the eastern states from Perth. And it makes a lot of sense to do it here. We had a lot of opposition, as you can imagine, from people in WA who were saying, well, it should be done here. And the moans still happen. But it doesn't stop WA coming to Tasting Australia this time. But it has, however, stopped Victoria from coming. And I'm actually a little peeved that Victoria have actually decided to boycott Tasting Australia. Because I have it on good authority that they want the event there and therefore they won't contribute to anything we do here. But the point is, they have a Melbourne Food and Wine Festival and this festival belongs here. And we will continue to run this restaurant here as long as it gets the support that we're seeing now it is getting in South Australia, which is phenomenal. Now, having done the first one, we attracted some 150 food and wine journalists from around the world, most of whom were sponsored to come here, either by SATC or by ATC, Australian Tourism in Sydney. We're delighted that this time we have more journalists coming, but fewer are being sponsored. Most of them are now saying, look, we'll pay to get ourselves there. You know, if you put us up on the ground, great. But we'll actually pay for the flights, which is terrific. We've also had huge response from Qantas, a major sponsor, who's actually saved us in an area which is the most expensive part of running Tasting Australia. So what began as a media event to promote South Australia quickly became the event which happens from next Sunday, which is a major media, public and industry event. Now, there's been a heap of publicity on it already, and I know that David Sly is busy writing down there for the advertisers' food and wine section, and we'll be running things every day next week. Now, the difference between the approach in the first one and in this one is that the media have got, that is the mainstream media, have got 100% behind this, which is exactly what we wanted, because it's all very well getting publicity in Gourmet Traveller and Vogue Entertaining, but what we have to do is to tell the people of Australia that good food and wine is a lifestyle thing. It's not about spending hours in the kitchen. In fact, many people I know need a handrail to find their way to the kitchen. But, you know, this sort of festival with new events like the Great Aussie Barbecue Challenge is the sort of event that says, look, good food and wine is about lifestyle, it's about nurture. And again, going back to consuming passions, one of the perceived reasons for its success is because, like Better Homes and Gardens, it is about nurture. It is making you comfortable because you've been watching Dilly on the news and you want something that is taking the pressure off and you want to feel that you belong to something, hence the play school for adults. So we now have Tasting Australia about to start, Tasting Australia 2. And I thought just before I concluded, I don't know how far into my half hour I am now, Don.
About 35 minutes.
About 35 minutes? Oh, good Lord. And not even a sip of water. I just thought I would like to before I leave you, show, with Judith's help, I hope, that you don't need even to have a kitchen to be able to cook. And especially for a lot of the visiting people coming in from other states. And if I could have the iron turned on, please, Judith. Or Jane, thank you. For people coming in from interstate, of course, staying in the hotels in Adelaide, they won't need to worry about this, but if they're staying in other states, they may need to do a bit of their own catering. So I've worked out ways of catering in hotel rooms. And in fact, one of the great dishes in Tetsuya Wakuda's, I don't know, most of you, if you haven't been to Tetsuya's in Sydney, please go. One of his signature dishes is a confit of ocean trout. That is, it's in oil and it's poached very, very slowly at a much lower temperature than most ovens will allow, which is why he can get away with it and we can't at home. But in a hotel that's got a sauna, you can get the better of him. So I actually tend to use the gym a bit. So I figure, look, I'll wrap up a bit of fabulous Atlantic salmon or some great South Australian tuna in some aluminium foil with some olive oil and a little pepper. And I put it in the sauna that's running at 80 degrees while I'm actually in the sauna next door. You can dry your clothes that way too, but it's a good idea not to put the clothes in the same sauna that has your fish. So I sit in the other sauna drying my clothes, and I hope that the staff from this hotel aren't going to worry too much about this. I wouldn't do it in your hotel. So you can be in one sauna losing a bit of weight while your meal is being cooked in the next one. Now, if I can actually, I can probably get Judith to come up here and demonstrate while I'm talking from here. Yes, Judith, if you come up onto the podium, and this is to show you how easy it is, because we all know how well Judith cooks. Actually, I don't. I'm sure you're a very good cook. But things like in room service, your food is always too cold when it gets upstairs. So what you can do is use the hairdryer. Now, Judith, if you put the croissant on the plate into the laundry bag, which is in every hotel room, now that you're washing your own laundry and not using the far too expensive laundry facilities, you simply put your croissant in the bag and then put the hairdryer. Most of you who know me well would know I don't need a hairdryer. Put the hairdryer into there and bunch the plastic, yes, around it. Not too much, because you'll... No, not around the back, because you'll suffocate the hairdryer. And do this for 3 or 4 minutes. And it's very meditative, and at the end of that time, you'll find that you've got a very hot croissant. The same technique may be used for meat pies and several other things. So thank you, Judith. Yes, we won't put that to the test. Now, another one I like to do... Oh, Judith. Fantastic. What a star. Now, another thing you can do is if you find a hotel that doesn't have a sauna, then you can use the ironing board over here. And if you would, Judith, you wouldn't mind obliging by just taking the top piece of paper off, put a little olive oil from the bottle onto the paper. Just don't splash it onto the ironing board, or I'll never be invited back to a press club lunch. Just a little olive oil on there. That's it. That's probably about right. Then just rub the fillet onto the olive oil to smear it across a bit. Yes, yes. Just rub the fillet generously over the olive oil. That's fantastic. Now, a little more. Turn it over. That's it for the... Yes. Now, get the pepper mill and just grind the pepper. Oh, missing the pepper mill. There it is. These, by the way, everyone who travels a lot should know that it's a good idea to travel with a pepper mill. A roll of baking paper and a large bottle of olive oil. And you put the paper on the top. And with the iron, usually I try something like a cotton setting, just iron the fish. That's it. And just hold it on there, Judith. Hold it there. That's it. Now, you do this. No, hold the iron on. Hold the iron on. It takes about a minute and a half, and you get that wonderful seared salmon. I kid you not. And we won't go through the exercise, but if you were then to turn over the fish and do the same on the other side, you would have... Yes. Yes. Turn it over and do the same. Obviously, this iron's only just been turned on. If you want to have a well-done piece of fish, you obviously use the linen setting. And I think it's all down to what we try to do with Tasting Australia and Consuming Passions, which is basically to make cooking and food fun. So thank you very much indeed. I didn't actually expect there'd be questions after that.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, questions from the media.
Now, questions from the media, where I hope this thing works. Please give the name of your organisation before you ask your question. Thank you.
So the first question is going to come from Robert Main, which makes me more than a little nervous.
So you should be too. Robert Main from the Bulletin, Ian. These two questions may be self-cancelling, but first of all, what's wrong with fish fingers? And B, why are you so thin, you bastard?
They actually sort of coincide, because what's wrong with fish fingers is that you can never, like peanuts, you can never stop at one. And the continual eating of those sorts of foods will make you rather larger than one would wish to be. But in fact, it often disappoints chefs who find that I send food back on the plate, because I actually eat small portions. And the reason I like foods like Tetsuya's foods and Chong Liu's is that although some people say after that kind of tasting menu, oh, let's go and eat, I actually find that I taste food instead of eating large quantities, but I'm actually, the reason I wear dark colours is because I'm not actually as thin as it may appear.
Rex Story, the advertiser. Could you describe to us the worst professional meal you've ever had?
The worst professional meal I've ever had?
The restaurant meal.
My God, Rex, that is question without notice. That's the tall order. I think one of the worst ones I had was probably in Carnarvon. And I think it was probably as a result of the heat. I put it down to the heat. But it was one of those motels where the menu had Thai style porterhouse steak. Actually, it wasn't Carnarvon, so take that back, because I don't want to upset anyone in Carnarvon. It's actually now that I've been given time to think, it was actually the judging of a regional culinary competition in the Riverina, where we'd gone through something like six teams, and the seventh team came along, and it was very old-fashioned table silver service, and the waiter, female waiter, incidentally, one of my pet hates is wait person. I mean, men or women, they're all waiters. So this waiter came in with pushing the trolley, and she was dressed in the sort of old-fashioned regulation motel outfit for that part of New South Wales. And she had the trolley and the burners and the little pan and the prawns and the bottle of brandy and the cream. And she said, "In your first course." And I was judging this with Peter Howard and somebody from the university up in Wagga Wagga. And she said, "I hope I get this right, because I've never done this before." And short of being work experience, I mean, it was as close as it came to that. So she tried flambeing these prawns, and this is a competition, remember, to actually find a finalist to come here for Tasting Australia. So she finished swamping these poor prawns, well, first of all, cindering them with this brandy, almost setting light to the motel. And then she flooded these things with cream and then slopped them onto the plate. And then the main course was meat. I mean, rare is one thing. This, and blue even, but this was something like a leg of lamb that was totally raw. And it had with it those purple potatoes that, I don't know, why not use it? If you want something purple, eat a beetroot. I mean, why go for purple potatoes? They're also not cooked. And they were served with this cold, lumpy gravy. And for dessert, guess what? Out came the trolley. We're going to have flambéed strawberries with brandy and cream. That, I think, Rex, is probably close to the worst one. Yeah.
Ian David Sly, food and wine editor of The Advertiser. The way that you've pitched Tasting Australia to the local market, it really has an emphasis on the actual festival, the week-long festival. Yet it seems as internationally you've pitched it much more heavily around the World Food Media Awards. What actually brings people to Adelaide for this event?
Well, what is bringing the world's media to this event is the World Food Media Awards. I mean, what better way of encouraging a bunch of journalists and food producers on television to a place than to have a competition where their egos can be pumped up and they can be sent back with fabulous trophies. And the Jam Factory trophies are superb in themselves, and I think, I mean, that's where it starts. You get the international media coming in, now the national media are coming in, and so basically you've got to get those people in to do the service to the state, which is to promote worldwide, and then you've got to bring the chefs and apprentices in. We've got something like 15 television crews who will be here during that week, from CNN, from one public broadcast network in America that has 200 stations, and these are people who are not doing, I shouldn't be saying this, 5-minute segments. They're doing serious, long items. The ABC has decided, at last, to do 5 half-hours called Tasting Australia, produced by Adelaide ABC, which is on Tasting Australia, which will be screened in January and February. And now, okay, it's not publicity for this event, but it sure makes the event and what we're doing here look pretty good in the future. And obviously, this event will take some time to build, and we think it's phenomenal the way it's built in just 2 years from the first event. I mean, phenomenal. And it's not just what we have seen happening from the industry, but also from the public. I mean, the support for the Great Aussie Barbie, I think all stations and TV networks and newspapers, barring two, in this town have entered. And again, it's a cunning plan, because if you get each media organisation to promote its barbecue team, then you save a bit of PR money. And as our friends over there at SATC table will appreciate, that's very important. Right, Denise? I hope I've answered that, David.
Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. Would you cook with and eat and promote genetically modified food? And as a food exporting nation, should Australia go down this path?
I'm glad you asked that question. I should put the glasses on now because this is serious. I think the issue of GM, I'm asked about this quite a bit recently. I've got a very good friend, Annie Mayo, who's over in Margaret River, and she's researching GM foods and is writing quite a bit for newspapers around Australia about GM foods. I'm extremely nervous about GM foods, I would have to say. I don't think enough has been done, and I don't think in the short term we can ever guarantee that GM foods are going to be safe. And I think on the other side of the coin is that I believe that that there are going to be markets there. In fact, we've seen that Europe has already rejected the notion of GM foods. And I think that if we are looking in Australia at promoting premium quality, clean, green foods, I really can't see us diving headlong into GM foods. I just don't think it makes any sense at all.
Ian. Lynn Rivers from Harris Scarf, Adelaide. I would love to know, do you have a preferred iron to prepare a fish?
I'm sorry, a preferred...
iron.
As in,
well,
is there a better type of iron? Because I always have dreadful problems with fish. Now, I've never even... but I'd adore to know a new way.
Well, look, I would love to answer that question, but since I have a program on ABC television, I can't actually tell you. But I'll tell you privately afterwards if you like.
Thanks. I'm just an old housewife. I'm not a newspaper. I'm not a reporter. But I do... write the Probus newsletter. I'd like to know, did you hurt yourself or is there no one to catch you, but why don't you fall over anymore at the end of your program?
Well, to be honest, and I, you know, because I know that none of this is being reported, I can tell you that it was my osteopath who told me that I couldn't do this anymore. You see, what I would do is I would use a large lamington, a giant lamington behind me, and I would actually collapse into it. Which was okay, but every time I went to my osteopath, I'd leave coconut all over her rooms, and she said, "You've got to stop. This is just getting out of hand." So, but I have been approached by a lot of mothers who've said, "Look, my kids adore it when you fall over. So,
yes.
Could you start falling over again?" But I will tell you that there are a couple of surprises in next year's series, which I've half made, which I'm sure will more than make up for the lack of falling.
Hello, Ian. Thank you very much for that lovely talk. I'm from the South Australian Chip Eaters Association. Chip Eaters Association.
Chip Eaters?
Chip Eaters, yes.
As in French fries or
As
Belgian
French fries.
French fries,
yes.
Oh, perfect.
I don't know if there's any us around here, but I'm sure there are. I've just returned from Brussels, and I had the wonderful carbonade of beef. You know, the beef made with the beer.
Yes, with beer.
And they claimed they made the best chips in the world, and I must say I agree with it. I don't think they came with mayonnaise, but how do they make these wonderful chips? They're kind of long and rectangular, very...
Well, the answer is, and for those who don't know, they're not French fries at all. They're actually Belgian fries. They were invented in Belgium. No, seriously, they were Belgian fries. And they are thinner than the sort of traditional old English chips, and they're fatter than the allumette, which are the French matchstick chips. But essentially, the secret is that when you've cut the chips, you wash them. I mean, always use good potatoes that aren't pumped up with water. But you wash them to wash surplus starch out. Then you drain them very well.
and then you plunge them into oil that is about 160 degrees, and that cooks them through so that they're soft and flaccid. And then you take them out, drain them, and then when you're ready to use them, which could be an hour later, you bring the temperature of the oil up to almost smoke point. The problem with saying to somebody, bring it up to almost smoke point, is that they'll say, well, we don't know when to stop, and then it's smoking, and then it's too late. So bring it up to when it's a bit hotter than that, to about 180. You can always test this, because if you drop a cube of bread into the oil, if it's hot enough, it'll fizz around the top, and that gives you an indication of the temperature, and then just plunge them into that hotter oil for about 30 seconds. And they'll come out, and then they won't be flaccid anymore. They will be good, stiff little Belgian chips. There's a very good recipe for it, actually, in my Consuming Passions Collection 3. I'm glad you asked the question.
Ian Dabler from the Sunday Mail. They say there's four great cuisines of the world, including French and Turkish. Do you think there'd ever be room for Australian cuisine to fit in there?
No, I don't. I mean, again, this is one of those questions, do we have an Australian cuisine? The reason that we thought up the idea of an Australian regional culinary competition was because there is no European cuisine. You know, there's no real French cuisine. It is made up of the regions of France. I mean, you still can go to places like Alsace-Lorraine, and you'll get a different quiche, you know, in one village to the village next door. You know, it might only be, you know, the addition of a piece of anchovy, but they will be different, and they keep to those traditions. And I don't think we'll ever see an Australian cuisine per se, but what we are seeing is an approach to cuisine in Australia that is certainly accepted now by people overseas as being a fresh approach to food that even California is not, despite the fact that they wave the flag of Californian food and wine. I don't think they've got a patch on what we're doing here.
Sonia Madigan, Sunday Mail. We've seen why you might get kicked out of motels or hotel rooms. I'm sorry to push the point, but I think everyone else might be curious as well. Why the heck do you get kicked out of school?
Oh, yes, I knew you'd ask that. No, I really couldn't. Well, no, I can't say. I mean, I was head of the house, and I went to a party, and I think I got back about 5 in the morning, and the house master was sitting with a torch waiting for me to come in through the window. And it was the language I used when discovered climbing through the window that I think got me the sack as much as anything else. Interestingly, the careers master there, because, you know, I wondered what to do, and when I was at school, the careers master, because it was a church school, his name was Ball, and he was actually, and this is dead serious, he was Canon Ball. And he was the careers master, and as anyone who's been to an English public school would know, you've got choices of three careers, basically. You go into law, the church, or the army. And I thought the Fourth Estate was probably a good choice in the end.
Kate Thompson, Women and Children's Hospital.
Ian,
we're obviously interested in what kids eat. Kids seem to be eating Big Macs, their parents aren't cooking at home, and we're really wondering what you'd like us to be doing in terms of promoting kids eating good food.
Well, I'm delighted you asked that question, Kate. No, honestly, I didn't ask her to ask the question. I'm involved, happily involved, with Women's and Children's Hospital's Good Food for Kids program, and I think it's something, again, that is an initiative of South Australia, which to my knowledge is not being done anywhere else, and it's exactly the sort of thing like Tasting Australia that you say, well, why isn't it being done, you know, why isn't something like this happening on a national basis, the marketing of food? And we've got to market the concept of good food and good eating to children, because they are the future chefs and they're the future consumers. And I do think that it's terrific that any initiative that gets a child to understand more about food, to grow food, to know how to buy food, to know how to handle food. Actually, at the event, well, I'd have to tell you this, the event that I was at on Monday, where there was a demonstration by a lot of children, I don't know how many there were, there were 64 children around 8 to 10 years old, were having their first crack at rolling dough, pasta dough, through rollers. And of course, one of the emphasis placed on good culinary practice is hygiene. So I don't know whether it was the City of Adelaide who were co-sponsors of this or the Women's and Children's Hospital who decided to give rubber gloves to all these children to wear. Now, I know one size may fit all adults, but a great big rubber glove on an 8-year-old is probably one of the most dangerous things you could do to a child. So needless to say, we had some rather amusing rubber fettuccine coming out of the bottom of some of these rollers. But seriously, though, I mean, we do have an enormous problem in reversing what is being done by the multinational fast food chains. I mean, it is absolutely appalling to think of what a child's diet is these days. And I mean, some of the statistics, which in fact I've got from the Women's and Children's Hospital about eating patterns nowadays. And apart from anything else, we've got a situation where people are not eating and preparing foods together. And I think that is another thing, that the decline in the lunch meal or the dinner together is something that I think is really quite pernicious, and it's something that I'm very keen to reverse any way I can. And I think that it starts in pre-primary and it goes right the way through, and it's teaching people in a non-didactic fashion about how to enjoy the food process from planting the seeds and then watching it grow and using things. And I think it's terrific. I was up in the Adelaide Hills where they're doing this Good Food for Kids project, and just seeing the enthusiasm with which these children are growing their own foods and handling foods and talking about foods and just loving the experience of feeling what it's like to prepare food as well as eating it. I think it's fantastic. I hope that answers your question, Kate, from the Women's and Children's Hospital. Two more quickies.
Milton Howard from VLLC Media. This morning I interviewed a lady who's going off to Cologne tomorrow to sell kangaroo meat in Europe. What do you think are her chances?
I think the chances are very good. Kangaroo and emu are actually more popular in Europe than they are here as foods. And I think, again, it's down to the fact that we do not market our foods well nationally. The wine industry has got things organised nationally. And I think with people like Hazel Murphy in London, I think extraordinary things are happening with Australian wine. But we're telling people that we've got great Australian wine. We're not doing it with food on a national basis. And I think that, with the Food for the Future Council in this state, for instance, promoting South Australia, I think it's fantastic that a group has got together like that. But why isn't there a national body to promote food? It'll happen, but the sooner the better. One more. I usually get questions about who does your hair, and the answer is, of course, as you're well aware, nobody does. Mother Nature tried, but failed miserably.
Ian, I'm John Ellicott. I was publicity officer for the ABC in Adelaide for 33 years. I noted that you were publicity officer in Western Australia. My question is, how did you escape from the ABC?
Very good question. It's easier to answer than how did I get thrown out of school. Eventually, after doing Consuming Passions for 1 year, they said, because I had 15 recipes, basically. When I started Consuming Passions, I had 15 recipes. I'd never worked in a restaurant. And I said to Paddy Conroy, "You're out of your mind. I've got 15 recipes. How many do you want?" He said, 50 to start with. So I did what any chef would do. I plundered recipes from everywhere. And eventually, I kid you not, I was a senior producer with the ABC of something like 15 years standing, and I was in the situation of having to do Consuming Passions in my spare time, and I would watch myself go to air at 5 to 7 at night and sitting in a TV studio, and then I would direct the news. And the ABC thought that was fine. And I didn't think so. And besides which, there's not much money in television unless you're in the sort of Kerry O'Brien league, and where you can make a success financially in food media is really publishing, which we're now doing. Hence the publication of my new hardback coming out next week from the ABC shops. And look, I just have to say, just in conclusion, before Don gets up, I just have to say that it's been bliss talking to you. I expected a somewhat sober gathering, since I knew it was largely made up of journalists, but I'm delighted to have had such a receptive audience. Thank you very much indeed.
You've obviously had a very hard life to make the next few minutes a little happier. This is a magnum of 1993 St. Hugo Kunawara Cabernet Sauvignon from Orlando, and it's absolutely wonderful. So thank you.
I have to say a quick thank you to Don, and also to mention that I have a wine called Artemis from another growing area, Margaret River. It's a Chardonnay. I'm auctioning an Imperial at the Odbins auction of Artemis. For those of you interested in buying something irreplaceable, and to remind you, an Imperial, I think, is Francine over there will tell me, it's 6 litres. I think it's 8 bottles with a hand-designed label, and proceeds go to the East Timor Relief Fund. So if you feel like a drop of good Margaret River Chardonnay, get up there. Thank you.